This is Kathy with the second half of the Herald and Review for the 25th of August. I would like to start with the obituaries now, turning to the ones posted for today. The first one is from Forsyth for Harley Connor. Harley Buzz Connor, 84, of Forsyth, Illinois, formerly of Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, died on Monday, August 22, 2016. Memorial services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 27, 2016, at Brittlinger and Earl Funeral Home, with visitation from 9:30 a.m. Saturday until service time. Burial will be at a later date. From Decatur, Kelly Jo Curran Courtney, 48, daughter of Doris Pandit Curran, chief of Versailles, Kentucky, and the late Ewell Curran, died Monday, August 22. Visitation is 5 to 8 p.m. Friday, August 26th, at Blackburn and Ward Funeral Home, 161 Broadway, in Versailles, Kentucky. A mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Saturday at St. Leo Catholic Church in Versailles. Memorial contributions are suggested to Taylor Manor Nursing Home, 300 Berry Avenue in Versailles, Kentucky. From Decatur, Frederick N. Hennemeyer, Mr. Fixit, 89, of Decatur, passed away Monday, August 22nd, 2016, in St. Mary's Hospital. Visitation to celebrate Frederick's life will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 27th, in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, and conclude with Masonic rites. Burial will be at Graceland Cemetery, and conclude with military honors conducted by the Macon County Honor Guard. Memorials are suggested to Carl Cancer Research or St. Jude's Children's Hospital. The family would like to extend a thank you to special friends Dwayne and Karen Seeger, Dr. Rakim, Nurse Julie Ford, and staff. From Forsyth, Mary Jane Osborne, 81, of Forsyth, died Friday, August 19, 2016. Visitation will be 2 p.m. Saturday, August 27th, in the First Lutheran Church. The funeral will be at 3 p.m. Saturday, August 27th, in the church. Memorials may be made to the First Lutheran Church in Decatur. From Decatur, Jean Larice Reese Sheehy, July 25, 1939 through August 19, 2016. There will be no visitation. A funeral mass will be held at Holy Family Church, 4100 South Franklin Church Street in Decatur, on Friday, September 2nd at 11 a.m. A celebration of life will be held immediately following the church service. If you wish to send flowers, they may be sent directly to the church or a donation to the Decatur Park Foundation in Jean Larice Sheehy's name to keep the beauty alive. And now turning to the opinion page for the paper. This is Kathleen Parker from Washington, and she writes for, this is her column. When I wrote the headline, Hillary's Heel, I was thinking of Achilles, not Bill, though the former president is usually within nipping range of his wife's pantsuit hem. Hillary Clinton's Achilles heel is her very Clinton-ness. Rather than tell the truth as soon as possible, a reluctance shared by her husband during his presidency, she has mastered the art of teetering along the knife's edge of truth. Like a gymnast on a balance beam, she manages to stay within the narrow parameters of lawfulness without losing her footing. But Hillary's long history of avoiding provable infractions despite hundreds of hours of investigations and millions in taxpayer expense, from Whitewater to Benghazi to her private email server, may soon come to an end, not with a gold medal, but with an Olympian loss of whatever faith remained in her integrity. A batch of emails released Monday made clear that the Clinton Foundation donors got access to the State Department. Some of the email was between Huma Abedin, Clinton's deputy chief of staff at the State Department, and an official at the charity. Not all requests appear to have been granted, but the coziness between State and the Clinton family charity exposes a troubling hubris and highlights the emptiness of her personal promise to President Obama to build a firewall between the two institutions when she became his Secretary of State. Among examples reported by the Washington Post, sports executive Casey Wasserman, whose own family's charitable organization has given the Clinton Foundation between $5 and $10 million, and whose investment company paid Bill Clinton $3.13 million in consulting fees in 2009 and 2010, sought a visa for a British soccer player with a criminal past. It was not granted. The Crown Prince of Bahrain, Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa, whose government had given $50,000 for the foundation, requested a last-minute meeting with the Secretary of State. Granted. U2's Bono, a regular at Foundation events, asked for help in broadcasting a live link to the International Space Station during a concert tour. Response from the state, no clue. These discoveries, among others, may not amount to much in terms of actual favors, but they cast doubt on the integrity of Hillary Clinton's word. They also go a long way toward confirming her critics' allegation that the Clintons were a global pay-for-play arrangement. One crucial fact is no longer in dispute. Foundation donors got access to the State Department. The emails became public through a lawsuit filed by Judicial Watch, a conservative watchdog group who were among 725 pages of Abedin's correspondence. The stash also included 20 emails between Abedin and Clinton that weren't included in the 55,000 pages previously provided to State. Meanwhile, the FBI has turned over about 15,000 other emails and documents to State that were discovered during the agency's investigation of Clinton's private server. Judicial Watch is trying to get those released as well. In the meantime, a State Department spokesman says that many of them were plainly personal. As if these developments weren't problematical enough, former Secretary of State Colin Powell last week denied Clinton's claim that he advised her to use a private server, as he had done, saying, "Her people are trying to pin it on me." According to Powell, Clinton had been using her server for at least a year before the two discussed how he had managed his email. Whether this constitutes a lie to the FBI, as some are claiming, or the result of a faulty memory, likely will keep busy bees buzzing for a while. But Clinton has bigger worries as more emails continue to trickle out, revealing who knows what. But what we already know from FBI Director James Comey is that his agency's investigation found insufficient evidence to charge Clinton, though he did say her handling of classified information was extremely careless and that she falsely testified to the House Oversight Committee on Benghazi that there was no classified material in any of her email. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, to Republicans, Clinton is a serial liar. To Democrats, she is the perennial target of a right-wing conspiracy. Both appear to be marginally correct. The question for voters may come down to this: how much, if any, substantive harm has Clinton's lack of absolute clarity on a given subject or event caused? The only definitive answer thus far is that she has deeply damaged whatever public trust remained, and for a candidate, this can be fatal. And this next editorial by Dana Milbank, titled "Hannity is Trump's Spin Doctor." Couple of quotes from him. In 2008, Sean said, "I'm a journalist who interviews people I disagree with all the time." But in 2016, he says, "I never claimed to be a journalist." From Washington: "Not since lawmakers diagnosed Terry Schiavo's condition from the Senate floor has there been such medical quackery in the political realm. Last week, Newsweek's Kurt Eichenwald reported that a letter attesting to Donald Trump's magnificent health, quote, 'He will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency,' was not from an internist, but from a gastroenterologist. The belly doctor boasted that Mr. Trump has had a recent complete medical exam that showed only positive results." Like for Giardia? That followed a segment on Sean Hannity's show on Fox News Channel, in which the host elicited speculation about Hillary Clinton's neurological health from a urologist. A urinary tract specialist, part of a Fox News medical A-team, speculated for Hannity that a photo of the Democratic presidential nominee being assisted by her Secret Service detail while climbing stairs could indicate dehydration, arthritis, back pain, or a fall. The original photo caption said she merely stumbled and was caught by her agents. "I'm not a doctor, but my brother is a urologist, and I went to night school for bartending. By current standards, therefore, I am qualified to diagnose Hannity as having professional dissociative identity disorder. He can't decide whether he's a journalist or a Trump operative." In Monday's New York Times, the primetime TV news host admitted to media columnist Jim Rutenberg that he has been privately advising Trump. Hannity, who, according to CNN, paid for a private jet last month to fly Newt Gingrich to meet with Trump, told Rutenberg that his unabashed promotion of Trump isn't a problem because he never claimed to be a journalist, except that he had, and he plays a journalist on television for an hour each weeknight. The affliction is common, apparently. Stephen Bannon, the head of Breitbart News, has become the chief executive of Trump's campaign. Fox News founder Roger Ailes, just ousted, is advising the campaign, too. The overt campaigning for Trump by the likes of Hannity, Ailes, and Bannon does no favors for conservatism. and Hannity's collusion with a candidate and his peddling of conspiracy theories in support of Trump undermine the many serious journalists at Fox News. But the network has been here before. Remember Glenn Beck? I tell you all the time I'm not a journalist, the self-proclaimed rodeo clown liked to tell his Fox News audience. Instead of journalism, Beck gave viewers paranoia, helping to create the fear and loathing in the electorate that gave rise to Trump. Before Fox finally showed him the door in 2011, Beck urged viewers to hoard food in their homes, spun endless conspiracy theories, and played with anti-Semitic stereotypes and violent imagery. Now Trump has run with Beck's apocalyptic themes, alarming even Beck, who has become a fierce critic of Trump. When Beck said recently that the Trump campaign's then-chairman, Paul Manafort, had been illegally soliciting foreign money, Hannity's Fox News colleague, Bill Riley, another Trump booster, cautioned Beck that he could end up in jail for disparaging Manafort. "That's my point," Beck replied, adding, "Donald Trump has people chanting, 'put them in jail' about the press. When is someone's opinion on a public figure something that is jail-worthy and not First Amendment protected?" Such a question might have troubled Hannity during those occasions when he fancied himself a journalist over the years. Instead, he has gone full grassy knoll, in a manner reminiscent of Beck. In recent days, he has floated the theories that Clinton's Secret Service agents carried a syringe to administer anti-seizure medicine to her. The syringe turned out to be a flashlight. And that a video showing what Hannity claimed were violent, out-of-control movements of Clinton's head was evidence of a seizure. She had been joking with reporters. While we're doing conspiracy theories, here's another. Could the highly unpopular Trump have won the GOP nomination if he hadn't had so much help from Fox News, and in particular from Hannity? A tally in April by the Liberal Think Process blog found that Trump appeared on Hannity's show 41 times in the first 10 months of his campaign. Hannity talked up Trump's poll numbers, defended Trump against accusations, and asked him questions such as, "Is it time for all American politicians to get rid of political correctness?" Now that Hannity acknowledges advising Trump, he needs only a title to make his role official. Maybe he could be Trump's personal physician. And as I said, that was an editorial that was written by Dana Milbank. And this is a Herald and Review opinion. What others are saying, art and artist can't be separated. Separate the art from the artist? That's what critics and fans say whenever their favorite creators do something awful. Ezra Pound was a fascist traitor, but that shouldn't stop us from enjoying his economy of language. Woody Allen has been credibly accused of molesting his adopted daughter, but we should set that aside in evaluating the psychological subtlety of his films. Now people are applying the separation rule to Nate Parker, director and writer of the forthcoming film The Birth of a Nation, and his co-writer Gene Celestine. As several media outlets have reported, they were accused in 1999 of sexually assaulting a woman while she was unconscious. Parker was acquitted and Celestine was convicted, but Celestine appealed and eventually prosecutors let the case drop. Years later, the woman committed suicide. Some people have called for a boycott of The Birth of a Nation, while others, including Alyssa Rosenberg at The Washington Post, have argued that Parker's and Celestine's past should not influence the public's evaluation of the film. There's certainly something seductive in the idea of watching a film without context or contamination. It sounds like a purer, more natural experience, but the truth is you can't separate art from the world that made the art, very much including the artist. A clean break, art over here, artist over there, is in most cases impossible. And judging by how most people interact with art, they don't really think it's desirable either. Audiences go to the new Quentin Tarantino precisely because he's an important and beloved director. People regularly look at the artist's past work and past reputation in deciding which films to see or which music to hear. When interpreting art, critics don't routinely separate out the artist either. Critics and fans respond to art based in part on what they know about the artist. So it makes sense that in some cases, for some people, knowledge of the artist's personal life is going to make them unable to enjoy the art and perhaps unwilling to engage with it in the first place. The corollary to separate the art from the artist is as bad artists can make good art. Well, of course they can. But reactions to art are complicated and individual. Speaking only for myself, I can't listen to Bill Cosby's stand-up routines anymore, although I used to love them. His appeal was tied up in his nice guy, everyman persona. Now that 50 women and counting have come forward to say that he's a rapist, that appeal is gone. Other people may still be able to enjoy Cosby's humor. There's nothing wrong with that, and I don't think people need to feel guilty about it, but neither is it proof that they found a purer, better way to think about art. Maybe I'll see The Birth of a Nation. Maybe not. I'm probably a little less likely to do so given the accusations against Parker and Celestin than I was before I heard about them. If I do go to see it, though, the fact that Parker and Celestin are black men responding to a century of racist representation in Hollywood will affect how I assess the film, and so will the fact that they've been accused of sexual violence. That was actually written by Noah Berlatsky for the Los Angeles Times. And a little bit of local sports. Now Healthy, St. Teresa's Line, Hoping for Consistency, by Aaron Dow. Cade McLeod's shoulder pain wouldn't subside. After an injury his freshman year, he braved through his sophomore season before getting an MRI in the summer of 2015. Turned out he had a torn labrum, and playing football his junior season was pretty much out of the question. As he watched Jakardia Wright emerge as a freshman to become one of the best running backs in the area, there was a little frustration of not being out on the line as well, but there was an overriding emotion, anticipation. I was happy to see him do better and better, because that means the next year we're going to be pretty good, McLeod said. Once we get the whole line straight, get in better shape in year two, we're going to be running the ball down everyone's throat, hopefully. That's the plan. With McLeod and junior Bo Branyan returning after not playing a down last year because of injury, the Bulldogs' offensive line puzzle is coming back together. They join Brady Moore and Sam Luckenbill, who were week one starters, as Nick Kemper and Jaden Smith are battling out the spot at center. That's an encouraging lineup for the first-year coach Mark Ramsey, who's trying to protect a running back that's receiving national recognition. It's a good line. You got some size, you got some athleticism, Ramsey said. I think it's going to be a really good line for Jakardia to run behind. McLeod and Moore will take up the guard spots, with Luckenbill and Branyan holding down the tackle spots. It's kind of backward from the old school thought where your big guys are the tackles, Ramsey said, but that's not the style of offense we want to run. We want to run the bigger guys at guard. Even one of those bigger guys, Moore, has shed 20 pounds in the off season through weight room to keep the line's athleticism high. It's worth pulling out all the stops, as the expectations couldn't be much higher, especially for the offense. With Wright returning from 152 carry, 1,557 yard, 16 touchdown season his freshman year, along with a three-year starting quarterback in Ryan Fike and three returning wide receivers, there's plenty of experience back. So even with the new scheme Ramsey is putting into place, there are seasoned veterans taking it in. We probably can't put a whole playbook at them week one, but I think we'll be close, Ramsey said. Change isn't new for this line, which had to adjust nearly every week at the start of the season. Not only did others have to sub in for those injuries, but positions were switched up as well. I had to move from left to right tackle, and then I was out for the Moroa game too, so we had to switch up the line for that, Luckenbill said. We got used to it. Definitely going without Cade and Bo hurt. For Branyan and McLeod, it hurt a little more. It's one of the toughest things I've ever had to experience, Branyan said. And Branyan's itching to throw a few blocks down for the sophomore he could only cheer on last year. It's amazing how he runs the ball, how big he is and how tough he is, Branyan said. He's amazing. Now there's a line with plenty of experience paired with Mark Ramsey and assistant Tim Rui, who have helped that line take the next step. Ramsey's resume is building on rushing attacks, including five state championship games in the 90s and early 2000s. His name widely known, thanks to his success at Central A&M and recently Shelbyville, Rui may have been a little more unfamiliar, but players have quickly respected his knowledge. Last year, our technique was kind of sloppy, and this year it's a lot better, Moore said. We're staying low, we're driving off the ball better, so him and Coach Rui have been doing a great job. Rui, he knows what he's talking about, Luckenbill said. Technique-wise, we're way ahead of last year. Last year it was kind of brute force. This year it's more natural, I guess. The first stop may be the toughest of the season. St. Teresa plays Tolono Unity, which took second in Class 3A last year and started the season off with a 41-28 win against the Bulldogs at home. The fact that Unity is strongly expected to contend for the Southern 3A spot in the championship game only amplifies this game. It's a game that may not be the best week one, but one of the best small school games all regular season. And where one of the Rockets' strengths lies is directly up against St. T's rushing attack. Seven Rockets return as starters on the defense, six of which make up the front seven. It's an immediate test to see what this rushing attack is capable of. I know we have a tall task in front of us week one, Ramsey said, but we're going to prepare like crazy and see what we get. Numbers rising, MacArthur eyes turn around. The generals will still be young but more experienced this year. For years, MacArthur's been able to do more with less. The generals made the playoffs 5 of the last 7 years coming into last season, despite numbers that would make more sense for a Class 3A roster than a 5A one. But trying to reach those 5 wins last year was a little daunting with a group that had very little varsity experience. The generals' offensive line held 2 freshmen and a sophomore and was expected to handle the pass rush of experienced schools in the Central State 8. A first-year sophomore quarterback was throwing to receivers that hadn't been out for football in years, if ever. So coming away with a 1-8 season, something MacArthur had not done for a decade, was somewhat understandable, just definitely not desired. I want people to see our team is getting better and working harder every year, MacArthur senior linebacker Luke Roberts said. Going over, passing the hump from last year, show people that we're not known for losing, get back to where we want to be. Even with the down year, MacArthur's camp has been bursting. The generals have fielded more than 80 athletes, and the most longtime coach Derek Spates has seen in the last 5 years. It allows you to accomplish a whole lot more in practice because, for one, you have the bodies to do it, he said. And then when you have those types of numbers, when you're approaching 80 or more, you start having more fierce competition. It's not some senior looking back and it's a sophomore. It makes those competitions more intense. Spates said he hasn't pounded the hallways more to get more players out. Many were a part of the program in the past and have come back for various reasons. We have a few new transfers. We have 1 new person altogether, Spates said. For the most part, everybody's been in the program at one time or another. That helps fill in a starting lineup that returns 14 players and includes quarterback Amir Brummett, who threw for 1,995 yards and 17 touchdowns last year. Once he started to get his feet under him, he threw for more than 1,400 yards in the final 5 weeks of the season. He'll have 4 linemen back as well, now with much more experience and size. Last year we were young, and it took a lot of heart to play against them. People who have been playing 4 years of high school football, junior lineman Keyshawn Thomas said. Add in not having to process as much and remember schemes while trying to handle opponents 2 years older and bigger, and MacArthur's thankful to be ahead of where it was last year. Their level of comprehension and retention is better because they're older, Spates said. Last year, with the amount of guys that we had who were freshmen coming from JFL, it was stunning to them what they had to process. Even those sophomores, some of them contributed on special teams on that playoff team in 2014, it was still a shock to their system. Now you see the kids being able to process information a whole lot better, a whole lot faster. We still have a lot of growing to do, but you can see them moving like experienced football players. Offensively, MacArthur will have to replace its top 2 receivers in Dallas McCain and Keymonta Johnson. But with Ammon Brummett, 20 catches for 438 yards, back and basketball player Adrian Williams now out with the team, Amir Brummett has a solid receiving tandem to start with. Junior Cameron Harper figures to come out of the backfield. Now that he's had a year running the offense, Amir Brummett knows that there's a higher expectation level. He's working on improvising less, sticking to the game plan more. I would say just being disciplined and doing what the coaches ask of us, he said of the biggest difference this year. Not going out there and doing our own thing, playing as a team and coming together. That being said, MacArthur is still a young team. Whether the generals can rebound right back to being a playoff team remains to be seen. Spates knows there will still be growing pains, but he wants to attack those goals full bore. I want to see us be fast, physical, mistake-free. I think if you play the game mistake-free, it's hard to beat yourself, Spates said. If you're physical, you can impose your will on the other team. And being fast, I mean, we preach to these guys, if you're going to make a mistake, make it going full speed and then let's correct it. But go full speed. And that's all I have time for today. We'll finish up the half hour with an interesting article for you. This is Kathy wishing you a good day, and thanks for listening.